Every single hour, the ocean swallows over 1 million tons of human-made carbon dioxide. But it doesn't do it alone. It actually relies on this invisible underwater workforce of billions of biological carbon engineers. And right now, well, we are systematically hunting them. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Yeah, glad to be here.
You know, when we picture the fight against climate change, our minds tend to go to some very specific, very terrestrial places. Like we think of vast fields of solar panels catching the sun, or, you know, we picture thousands of saplings being planted to rebuild a forest. We think green.
Exactly. We very rarely, if ever, think blue.
Right. And we almost never picture a school of fish, which is why we're doing this.
And that's a massive oversight, quite frankly. I mean, we have this tendency to look at the ocean as just a passive victim of climate change. We hear about warming waters, rising sea levels, coral bleaching. But we forget that the ocean is actually our biggest active ally in regulating the global climate.
And that is exactly the mission of our deep dive today. We are exploring a fascinating 2024 paper from NTJ Ocean Sustainability. And we're trying to understand exactly why managing our fisheries, meaning, you know, the decisions we make about how, where, and how much we fish, is actually a highly effective form of carbon management.
Yeah, it completely flips the script on how we view marine conservation.
Oh, really does?
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can understand how human fishing disrupts the climate, we first need to understand the natural machinery of the ocean, right?
Yeah.
Like, how does the ocean actually breathe?
To understand that, you really have to grasp the sheer just the mind-boggling scale of what we call the ocean's biological pump. I mentioned earlier that the ocean takes in over 1 million tons of our CO2 every hour.
Which is just a crazy number to wrap your head around.
It is. And historically, the ocean has absorbed about 28% of all human-emitted CO2 since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, so around 1750. But here's the critical part, that carbon doesn't just sit on the surface.
Right. Because if it did, the surface would just, like, fill up, so to speak.
Yeah. Exactly. It would saturate, and the ocean couldn't take in anymore. So the biological pump is this incredible, continuously running system to clear that surface space. It starts up top, where inorganic carbon is captured by microscopic marine plants, phytoplankton, through photosynthesis.
Right.
But for that carbon to be truly locked away from the atmosphere, it has to be moved down into the dark, crushing depths of the ocean. And this is where the fish come in. They are the vital carbon engineers.
I just love that phrase, the idea of fish as engineers.
Yeah.
Because they aren't just, you know, swimming around randomly. They are actively working the machinery of the ocean.
They really are. And the data shows marine fish contribute an estimated 16% of the world's organic carbon export.
Wow, 16%.
Yeah. They take the carbon they consume at the surface and they physically package it. And, well, primarily they do this through their waste, their fecal pellets.
Wait. We're talking about fish poop. That's the great climate savior.
I know it sounds absurd, but biologically it is incredibly efficient because these pellets are they're relatively large and dense, so they sink rapidly through the water column.
Ah, so they fall fast.
Right. That rapid sinking is the whole key to the process. It locks the carbon away in the deep ocean before it has a chance to decompose in the surface waters and release the CO2 back into the air. This single mechanism, just fish waste sinking, drives more than 20% of all deep ocean respiration and carbon sequestration.
That is incredible. And, I mean, it's not just the waste sinking passively, right? The
yeah.
fish themselves are doing a lot of the heavy lifting because the research focuses a lot on the twilight zone of the ocean, right? The mesopelagic zone.
Yes. The mesopelagic zone is this deep, dark layer of the ocean that is just teeming with life. We are talking about an estimated 20 billion metric tons of fish biomass in that layer alone.
20 billion tons.
Just in that one layer. And these fish perform a daily routine called diurnal vertical migration, or DVM.
Okay, so think of these mesopelagic fish like an oceanic commuter elevator.
Oh, I like that.
Right. Because every night they travel up to the surface waters to feed, which is effectively loading carbon into their bellies.
Mm-hmm.
And every day, when the sun comes up, they commute back down to the oceanic basement, the deep sea,
yeah.
to avoid predators. And once they're down there, they deposit that carbon as waste, or they just respire it. They're literally pumping carbon into the deep.
What's fascinating here is how perfectly you just described one of the Earth's most efficient natural sequestration mechanisms. By physically moving and repackaging that surface carbon into dense, fast-sinking forms, they are essentially taking carbon out of atmospheric circulation for decades or even millennia.
And they just do this every single day.
every single day. It is a brilliant, self-sustaining system. And DVM alone contributes 10 to 40% of all deep ocean carbon export.
Okay, so if the fish are the elevators and the engineers of this whole carbon cycle, the obvious solution is just to, you know, leave them alone. But what actually happens to the climate when we systematically remove them from the water by the billions?
Well, the short answer is the machinery starts to break down. The ocean becomes much less capable of buffering against climate change. Historically, commercial fishing has halved the total biomass of exploited marine species.
Halved? We've removed half of them.
We have literally removed half the workforce, yes. And the trend, unfortunately, isn't improving. In 1974, about 10% of fish stocks were fished at unsustainable levels. By 2019, that number had jumped to 35.4%.
So over a third of all the fish populations we target are being depleted faster than they could physically reproduce.
Exactly.
But let me push back on this for a second, just to play devil's advocate. I get that a tuna or a shark is big, but compared to the sheer incomprehensible size of the global ocean, does removing some large fish really make a dent in the global carbon cycle? Like, it sounds like a drained in the bucket.
It's intuitive to think that, absolutely. But apex predators have a massively disproportionate impact. Let's look at large marine vertebrates. You know, your massive tuna, sharks, and mackerels. Because we've been extracting them so heavily since 1950, we have prevented 21.8 million metric tons of carbon from being sequestered.
Wow. Just from catching large fish?
Just from that.
Okay. How exactly are they sequestering that much? Is that just from their waist too?
No, it's mostly their bodies.
Uh-huh.
In nature, when one of these massive fish dies, its carcass creates what marine biologists call a deadfall.
A deadfall. Okay.
Right, because they are so heavy, they sink rapidly to the ocean floor, taking all the carbon stored in their tissues with them. That carbon is then buried in the sediment. But when an industrial fishing operation pulls a massive tuna out of the ocean, that deadfall never happens.
Because it ends up on our plates.
Exactly. We eat the fish, and that carbon is eventually released back into the atmosphere.
Wait, so every time we pull a massive, mature tuna out of the water, we're essentially like logging an old growth tree. By intercepting it, we're preventing that carbon from sinking and locking away in the deep sea.
That is exactly the mechanism at play. Those large carcasses represent a massive missing carbon sink. But it's actually worse than just the missing bodies. By removing the top predators, we are truncating the entire marine food web.
We're stripping out the heavy lifters.
Right. We are stripping out the heavy lifters, the biological pump. Without them, the entire ecosystem becomes far less resilient to climate stressors.
Okay, so taking the fish out breaks the pump. But the research points out that the actual method we use to take them out might be even worse. And I think we need to talk about bottom trawling.
Yes, we definitely do. If removing the fish disrupts the biological pump, bottom trawling actively destroys the ocean's biggest carbon vault, which is the seabed.
The seabed is a vault.
A massive one. Over millions of years, through deadfalls and sinking waste, marine sediments have become a globally important carbon store. To put the scale in perspective, the top meter of marine sediment stores more than double the amount of carbon found in all terrestrial soils combined.
Double. Double all the soil on land.
Double all of it.
And this carbon can stay locked away in the cold, dark sediment for centuries, right?
Yeah.
As long as it's undisturbed.
Precisely. But bottom trawl fisheries do exactly the opposite of leaving it undisturbed. They drag incredibly heavy nets, chains, and doors across the seafloor to catch species that live on the bottom.
Like shrimp and flounder, right.
Exactly. Mm. And they land about 19 million tons of catch every year. That's nearly a quarter of all wild-caught marine fisheries.
I mean, it sounds like we're essentially taking a giant industrial rototiller to a pristine rainforest floor just to catch a few specific types of shrimp. And we're just completely ignoring the massive clouds of carbon dust we're kicking up into the water in the process.
That is a very accurate way to picture it. And that collateral damage is immense, not just to the seafloor, but to the marine life itself. Trawl fisheries are responsible for an estimated 60% of all global fisheries discards.
Discards meaning?
That is marine life they catch by accident, pull up, and then throw back, usually dead.
That's awful.
It is. But going back to your rototiller analogy, it's perfect for the sediment. Trawling physically erodes the fine-grained, carbon-rich particles. The data shows heavily trawled areas have a 30% decline in organic carbon compared to untrawled areas, and up to a 70% depletion of labile carbon compounds.
Hold on, let me stop you there. Labile compounds. What does that actually mean for the ecosystem?
Right, sorry. Labile compounds are essentially the easily digestible, high-energy food sources for the seabed ecosystem. They are the organic materials that benthic organisms, the creatures living in the mud, rely on to survive.
Okay.
So when you deplete those by 70%, you are basically starving the bottom of the food chain.
Okay, so we are starving the ecosystem. But what about the carbon we just rototilled into the water column? Does it just, I don't know, settle back down politely after the net passes?
This raises an important question about the permanence of the damage. And the answer is no, it doesn't just settle back down. When you churn all that deep sediment up, you fundamentally alter the chemical pathways.
How so?
Well, you are taking sediment that has been deprived of oxygen for thousands of years and mixing it into oxygen-rich water. This oxygenates the mud and triggers a process called remineralization.
Wait, remineralization? What is actually happening at a chemical level when that net drags across the bottom?
Right.
Like, why does oxygen hitting the mud matter?
Think of it like opening a sealed jar of food. When the carbon is buried in the anoxic or oxygen-free mud, the microbes that want to eat it can't operate very well. But the moment the trawl net kicks that carbon up into the oxygenated water, microbial life goes into overdrive.
Oh, they just feast on it.
They do. They consume that organic carbon and respire it, converting it back into aqueous CO2.
Aqueous meaning it's dissolved in the water.
Yes, meaning CO2 dissolved in the water.
And how much CO2 are we talking about here?
The estimates are staggering. It's calculated that bottom trawling could release nearly 1.5 billion metric tons of aqueous CO2 in the first year alone.
1.5 billion metric tons.
Yes. Now, because it's dissolved in the water, it doesn't all hit the atmosphere immediately.
Right, because it's aqueous.
Exactly. But the research indicates that 55 to 60% of that aqueous CO2 will eventually release, or off gas, into the atmosphere within 9 years. We aren't just releasing stored carbon, we are physically destroying the sediment's future capacity to bury carbon.
Okay, I am genuinely confused here. If high sea fishing and bottom trawling are this destructive, you know, this ecologically devastating, and they are essentially sabotaging our global fight against climate change, how is this a viable business model? Why does this happen on such a massive scale?
It comes down to basic economics and, ironically enough, our dependence on fossil fuels.
Right, because these industrial fleets aren't out there in rowboats.
Exactly. They're massive ships. The global fishing sector accounts for roughly 1.2% of global oil consumption. As coastal stocks have been depleted, fleets have grown larger, heavier, and more powerful, allowing them to travel much further offshore. Consequently, their emissions have skyrocketed. Between 1990 and 2011, greenhouse gas emissions from the fishing sector alone rose by 28%.
But here's where it gets really interesting. They're even doing this on their own dime, are they? If we look at the financial data from the paper, in 2018, the global fishing industry received $35.4 billion in government subsidies.
Yep.
And a massive 22% of that went specifically to fuel subsidies.
That is the crux of the entire issue. Without those taxpayer subsidies, up to 54% of landings from the high seas and deep sea bottom trawling in general would be completely economically unprofitable.
So they just lose money.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. It simply costs too much in diesel fuel to sail that far out, drag incredibly heavy gear across the ocean floor, and freeze the catch.
So let me get this straight. We're literally paying tax dollars to subsidize the burning of fossil fuels, to send industrial fleets out to the middle of the ocean to catch fish that otherwise wouldn't be profitable. This stops those fish from storing carbon while also destroying the ocean floor, which releases even more carbon. I mean, it's a taxpayer-funded climate doom loop.
It really is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the doom loop is actually accelerating. Because we've overfished so many coastal stocks, boats have to travel further and fish for much longer hours just to catch the exact same volume of fish they used to.
Oh, wow.
This means they burn significantly more fuel per unit of seafood landed.
They're working harder to do more damage for less food.
Exactly. And now, add climate change to the mix. As the oceans absorb all that excess heat we've been trapping in the atmosphere, marine species are physically shifting their distribution toward the poles to find cooler water. The models project that 23% of shared fish stocks will shift by 2030.
So they're moving away.
Yes. So the fleets will have to chase them even further from port, burning even more subsidized fossil fuel to do it.
Okay, I have to ask about the human element here. Who is actually getting these subsidies? Is it the local small-scale fishermen down at the dock trying to feed their community?
Mostly no. Only 19% of global fisheries subsidies go to small-scale fisheries.
Just 19%.
Yeah. And this is despite the fact that small-scale operations employ 90% of all fishers worldwide.
That is wild.
The overwhelming bulk of that $35 billion goes directly to the large industrial fleets that are causing most biogeochemical damage.
Okay, we've outlined a pretty bleak picture of this doom loop. How do we break it? Because the takeaway here can't just be that the ocean is doomed. The argument in the paper is that we need to treat fisheries management not just as an ecological necessity, but as a crucial climate mitigation strategy.
Right. Good fisheries management is the key. And what that practically means is taking immediate steps to eliminate overcapacity in the fleets, phasing out destructive practices like bottom trawling, and ending those harmful fuel subsidies that make overfishing artificially profitable.
Right. You take away the fuel subsidies, a lot of the deep sea trawling stops itself.
Exactly. We have to move beyond the old management model. Historically, we just tried to calculate the maximum sustainable yield of a single fish species in a total vacuum.
Meaning you just, like, count the tuna and try to figure out exactly how many you can take without the population crashing.
Exactly, which ignores how nature actually works.
Yeah.
We need a modern ecosystem-based approach. You have to account for the entire food web. What does the tuna eat? Where does it migrate? You have to account for illegal and unregulated fishing, the massive amounts of bycatch, and crucially, the socioeconomic needs of the coastal communities that rely on these waters for survival.
But is the damage permanent? Like, if we stop trawling tomorrow and implement this ecosystem approach, can these populations actually bounce back, or have we crossed a tipping point?
The good news is that nature is incredibly resilient if we just give it space and time. A classic example is the Atlantic cod. The cod suffered a massive catastrophic population collapse in the mid-20th century due to decades of intense industrialized overfishing. People thought they were gone for good.
I remember that, yeah.
But recent genomic studies show something remarkable. The surviving cod have actually retained the genetic diversity needed for a full recovery.
So the blueprint for their survival is still completely intact. Yeah. They just need us to stop hunting them so aggressively.
Precisely. To facilitate that recovery, researchers strongly recommend implementing no-take marine protected areas covering more than 10% of the distributions of exploited species.
No-take zones.
Yes. By creating these vast, undisturbed zones, we can give overexploited fish biomass a real chance to rebuild, which in turn rebids the biological carbon pump.
So what does this all mean for you? If you are listening to this, you probably aren't writing international maritime policy or commanding a trawler fleet, but you are a consumer. You eat seafood, or you vote for politicians who regulate these subsidies. Realizing that making informed, sustainable seafood choices isn't just about saving the whales or protecting a single charismatic species of fish. It is directly, mechanically tied to the global carbon cycle. Your seafood choices are a massive climate issue.
And that is a powerful reframing for all of us. Protecting Earth's natural carbon sinks, like the seabed and the fish populations, is one of the lowest cost, most effective climate strategies we have available to us today.
Because nature does the work for free.
Exactly. Rebuilding fish stocks means boats burn less fuel because they don't have to search as hard or travel as far. Ending bottom trawling protects the sediment vault and drastically reduces fuel use simultaneously. Good fisheries management protects not just marine biodiversity, but the socioeconomic stability and food security of millions of people who depend on a healthy ocean.
It's a win-win.
It really is. Knowledge is only valuable when it's applied, and applying this knowledge could literally change the trajectory of our climate.
It really is all connected. From the tiny fecal pellets sinking rapidly in the dark, to the price of diesel fuel, to the amount of carbon in our atmosphere, we've gone from fish poop driving the biological pump, to the physical destruction of the seafloor by rototilling the sediment, all the way to the economic absurdity of taxpayer-funded fuel subsidies for industrial fleets.
It is a delicately balanced system, and every single piece matters.
Which actually leads me to a final thought I want to leave you with. It's something of a paradox, pulled from some of the knowledge gaps the researchers themselves pointed out in their modeling.
Oh, this is a great point.
Let's say we successfully ban or phase out bottom trawling globally. The ocean floor would be saved, and all that sediment carbon would remain locked away for millennia. But millions of people still need to eat seafood, right? So we would have to transition to alternative, less destructive fishing methods. But what if those alternative, safer methods turn out to be less effective at catching the sheer volume of fish we demand?
That is the big looming unknown.
Right. If the new nets are less efficient, fleets might have to stay out on the water much, much longer to meet their quotas. Could we accidentally trade lower ocean floor emissions for significantly higher fossil fuel emissions from those prolonged, endless boat trips? It just shows how incredibly complex and delicately balanced this entire system is. Every solution requires us to look at the whole board, not just one piece.
It's a reminder that we have to be rigorous. We can't just solve one environmental problem by blindly creating another. We have to look at the entire life cycle and the unintended consequences of our policies.
Exactly. We hope this deep dive has helped you see the ocean and the billions of fish working inside it in a completely new light. The next time someone asks you about capturing carbon, you can tell them to forget the trees for a minute and start thinking about the fish. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the hidden connections in the world around you, and we'll see you next time.